Well, we've already had read to us today Psalm 37, and if we again just read together the third verse, which is, "Trust in the Lord and do good, so shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed." And what I'm going to look at this afternoon is a series of sieges. A series of sieges, and I think it'll be an appropriate message given who we have here today, the apprentice boys of Derry, and also given the fact it is the 100th anniversary year of our country of Northern Ireland. Back in the 1600s, it appeared to be a popular pastime of Roman Catholics to attack Londonderry. We begin, first of all, in that opening year, 1600 itself, and after an English garrison had returned to the area during the 9 Years' War, they were fighting the Gaelic Earls O'Neill and O'Donnell. This time, the English managed to hold on to Derry, and whenever war came to an end, 3 years later, a small trading settlement was established in the area, and it was given the legal status of a city. But it wasn't long after that. 5 years later, on from 1603 to 1608, during the O'Doherty's Rebellion, that the fledgling city there was attacked by Cathair O'Doherty. He was the Irish chieftain of Inishowen, and the settlement that had been established just 5 years earlier was virtually wiped out. That wasn't, as you can well imagine, the end. In 1641, the Irish insurgents made a field attack in the city during what was known as the Irish Rebellion. And the city became very vital over the next number of years for 10 years of war. Then Derry and its environs became a stronghold for the British Protestant settlers. They raised then the Lagan Army to defend themselves from the marauding Irish Confederates. Then, of course, we come to that famous year, 1688, running into 1689, when our country in Ireland became the battleground for the glorious revolution in England. James II was deposed by William, Prince of Orange, and the city of Derry again reached headline news in 1688, 1689, because of the longest ever siege in Europe, 105 days being led against it. Now, the key fact about that siege of Derry is this. While the Battle of the Boyne, in July of that next year, of course, secured William of Orange's position as king in Britain and also king in Ireland, victory down there at the Boyne would have been very highly unlikely apart from a successful outcome to the siege of Londonderry. And so that's where we're going today, speaking on a number of sieges, 3 in total, a series of sieges, beginning with the initial one in 1688 through to 1689. James II brought all kinds of issues when in 1685 he came to the throne of England. He was a devout Roman Catholic, and he immediately launched a campaign to push his Catholic subjects into positions of high office all over the country. The civil establishment, the military establishments, they were both overturned. Up to this point in time, they had been overwhelmingly Protestant. But James decided, I'm going to replace those with my own people. And so radical was that transformation that by 1688, the army in Ireland was almost 100% Catholic. One of the very few places where you would have come across Protestant soldiers was in Londonderry itself. Now, by the end of that year, in 1688, the population of the city was 2,000 people. The vast majority Protestant settlers, people who, in the words of the historian Macaulay, were Episcopalians, Church of England, Church of Ireland, and also Presbyterians, and he notes they generally lived together in friendship, a friendship which is sufficiently explained by their common antipathy to the Irish race and to the Popish religion. But while they were together in fair harmony in the city of Londonderry, activities were taking place all across the country that caused the collection of Protestants in the city some genuine fear. despite the religious makeup of the population. A predominantly Catholic corporation, we'd call it a town council today, had been appointed to run the city back in 1867. You can imagine, being a Londonderry Protestant at that particular time, you wouldn't be too happy to find maybe the equivalent of SDLP, Stroke, Sinn Féin, whatever, and they're in charge of your city and they're controlling your interests at that time. That disturbed them. And it further ramped up an alarm that was sweeping among the Protestants of Ireland coming to the close of 1688 when it became known, do you know what's happening out there in the country? We have got Roman Catholics and wholesale, they are storing up pikes and knives. Priests had been at their business and they were stirring up again anti-Protestant passions just as they had back in 1641. And so the Protestants in Londonderry were becoming extremely nervous and thinking there's going to be another horrific massacre of our people here. That fear and that alarm was heightened by an order received from the army's high command. For years, Lord Mountjoy's regiment of foot were garrisoned in the city of Londonderry. That was their only line of defence. But quite suddenly, James Mann in Ireland, who was the Earl of Tyrconnell, he ordered that regiment to get out of the city of Londonderry, quit it, and withdraw all the way down to Dublin. And instead they announced, Londonderry is going to be garrisoned by a new Catholic force, consisting entirely of Irish troops, Scots Highlanders, the Red Shanks they called them, and they were to be under the control of the Earl of Antrim. Had those men been ready to march, they would have gone and replaced Mountjoy's regiment in the city before it left Londonderry on the 23rd of November. But as it turns out, there was a delay. One reason for the delay was we have the Earl of Antrim assembling his band of Red Shanks, and he's very particular because he wants a fine-looking body of men under his control. And he needed a condition of recruitment back then that every member in my regiment should be around 6 feet tall. Now that wouldn't be a problem today because their children are bigger than their parents, and so it keeps going as the years go by. A 6 feet tall army may not be too difficult to muster now. Back then, it would have been a considerable challenge. So it took time to organise. And it meant that Londonderry had no garrison within the walls when more fearful news still reached the city. And the third thing that happened to really pump up the fear was the Cumber letter appeared on the 3rd of December of 1688. It warned of a massacre of Protestants in the northern part of Ireland on the 9th of December. That was the date when the massacre should be taking place. And so these citizens in Londonderry, you can imagine, put yourself in their shoes. They're convinced that Antrim's men, the Red Shanks, coming towards their city, their own garrison being withdrawn to Dublin, that's all part of the overall plan to wipe us out. And they didn't have long to wait to see the whites of the eyes of those Red Shanks. On the 7th of December of 1688, we have the advance force of the Red Shanks coming to the east bank of the city. Two of the officers, they cross the River Foyle, and they demand quarters for our men and also food for our horses. But there was a bit of a clerical oversight that had gone on. It meant the warrants they brought over to the city were unsigned, and that technicality gave the city sheriffs a bit of extra time to debate and consider, what are we going to do? In other words, will we close the gates of the city or not? So there's a debate, and it's raging inside the city. And there's a division there. Essentially, the older people were very reluctant to close the gates of the city against the king's army. But the younger people had no such hesitance. They were convinced the second massacre of Protestants is about to begin, and they didn't listen to the older ones. And then when he looked out again, and they saw that the vanguard of the regiment had started to cross the River Foyle by ferry, and they're headed towards a landing place near Fergie Gate, well, their mind was fully made up. So we have the 13 apprentice boys made the decision A decision which, according to C.D. Milligan, was to prove momentous for Protestantism in Ireland, important for the future of England and Scotland, and fatal for James. Led by Henry Campsie, those 13 men drew their swords, ran round to the main guard, seized the keys, rushed to the Fergie gate, drew up the drawbridge, locked the gates, and those red shanks by this stage were only 60 yards away, almost inside the city. They then ran round to the other three gates at the time, Bishops and Butchers and Shipkey Gate, and locked those as well. The red shanks stood there dumbfounded. What do we do? Well, one of the boys on the wall decided that he would help them make up their minds. James Morrison, standing in the ramparts outside the Fergie Gate, he shouted at them to go away. When they continued to linger, he then called, "Bring about a big gun here," and that settled the issue. Back over the foil they went. Now, that debate continued on within the city. Should we bring Antrim's men in? After all, they are the king's forces. And they had a meeting of the Protestants in the city, in the town hall, that evening. Deputy Mayor was in favour, open up the gates and let the soldiers in. The Bishop of Derry at the time, Dr. Ezekiel Hopkins, supported him. Yes, open the gates, they are the king's men, let them in. But even as the Bishop of the city was speaking in that meeting in the town hall, one man stood up, interrupted him and said, "Your sermon is very good, but we haven't the time to listen to it now." Probably that's a preacher's dread any time he does speak. And I hope I'm not giving you ideas by saying that today. A citizens' committee was formed to plan the defence of the town, because defend it they knew they would have to do. And so support was pouring in from the countrysides all around. And from that time on to the end of the siege, we have many parties of Protestant refugees. Some of them were useful fighting men. They were very welcome. Others were just another collection of hungry mouths to feed, and they constantly arrived in the city. Inside that city, George Phillips, who was a former governor of the city, was admitted to the city and reappointed as its governor. The keys of the magazine were handed over to him. Not that he'd much to look at when he opened the door of the magazine, because I'm told there was one barrel of gunpowder and not much more at that particular time. The citizens inside composed letters, and they sent them out to the great and the good, appealing for help that would defend them against their adversaries that had come in. They did say, "We have resolved," in these letters, "we have resolved to stand upon our guard and to defend our walls, and not to admit any Papists whatsoever to quarter among us." Now, on that fateful night of the 9th of December, there was hardly a Protestant house in which the lights were not left burning during the night, and most of them, had you been walking along, you'd have found an armed man here, there, right across the city, on guard outside those houses. 2 weeks later, on the 21st of December, the Red Shanks were suddenly withdrawn just as quickly as they had come, and an all-Protestant force under Lieutenant Colonel Robert Lunding was received into the city. By that stage, major events were about to unfold. Down in the southern part of Ireland, we have the Irish nation being called to arms. On the Dublin Castle, there was a flag raised carrying the slogan, "Now or never, now and forever." And all over the country, Irish peasants, they abandoned their potato patches, they flocked to the colours, the priests continued to stir up their congregations to seize the day when, as they told them, you can openly fight for the Catholic faith, and you can take the country for James and for the Pope. An Irish army that had consisted only of 8 regiments now mushroomed to 48 regiments. And this swollen Irish army took everything they could from Protestant hands. Horses, we'll have those. Cattle, we'll take those too. Your lands, we'll have that as well. Whatever the army left, the bands of marauders coming in behind them, they snapped up. Again, the historian Macaulay estimated that by February of 1689, at least 100,000 Irish men were in arms, one half were soldiers and the other half bandits. Well, what was their goal? What were they looking for? I go to another historian, Thomas Witherow, who said they were fighting for the king and his religion, Catholicism, and they were fighting to reduce the north to subjection. And if that sounds familiar, it's only because it is. Reduce the north to subjection. It was quite impossible for the Protestants to resist this kind of an onslaught, and well, they knew that. And houses up and down the country, coming from Dublin right through Louth, etc., those fortified houses, they surrendered. The occupants were only too happy if they escaped with their lives. But many of them, rather than submit, they packed up whatever belongings they could, and then they burned the rest of them, and they headed off for one of two places, either in Enniskillen, where there was a walled city, or Londonderry, where there are very much walls, an important walled city. April 1689 was the decisive month. The King, William of Orange, he promised arms and ammunition, and he stirred up the city to prepare itself for some determined resistance. But Lundy within the city, in charge of the army there, had no stomach for the fight. He was replaced by joint governors, Major Henry Baker and Reverend George Walker, who had come from the parish of Donoughmore in County Tyrone and was taking refuge with all of those others in the city. They stirred up 8 regiments of able-bodied men, every man given his orders, and when all had left the city who wanted to leave the city, they had 20,000 people remaining within the walls. 7,020 men able to fight, and 341 officers looking after them. But then at Bishop's Gate, on the 19th of April, this pivotal month, a Jacobite trumpeter came to that gate, and he asked, "You know, the promise that was made by Governor Lundy of an easy surrender, is that going to be kept?" The next day, Lord Strabane, who was a high ranker within the Jacobites, he was sent to offer terms to the city. It was an ultimatum. It would, they said, "You will not be submitting yourselves to anybody other than the rightful king. It's no big deal. He is your loyal sovereign. It's the least that you can do." And he went on to say, "I'll offer you pardons." And that fellow, Adam Murray over there, who seems to be taking on quite a large aspect in controlling you, he'll be a colonel in the new army of ours, and we'll give him a gift of £1,000. That was a big bribe back in those days. But Adam Murray replied to the officer and he said, "The men of Londonderry have done nothing that requires a pardon, and own no sovereign but King William and Queen Mary." And at that point, on that day, 19th and then the 20th of April of 1689, that was the day when the siege proper of Londonderry began. The city was soon on fire in certain places. Many were crushed, their houses fell on them, when the cannons from the Jacobites found their targets. There was an expedition sent over from Liverpool, and that was to give relief to the city of Londonderry, under Lieutenant General Percy Kirk. And they saw, up there in the cathedral, no doubt, we'd have seen the flags of the ships coming up the foy. And they were rejoicing on the 14th of June when they saw them, and hope blazed eternal for those that were defending the city. But that hope turned quickly to despair, later descended into misery, because what's happening? Kirk is staying out there in the foil, not coming forward any further, and he was inactive for several weeks at the entrance to Loch Foyle. During this time, famine was rampant in the city. Pestilence followed in the wake of the horrible hunger. They were selling horse flesh. It was just about the only meat that you could purchase. Even that was in very short supply. They had tallow, animal fat, as a substitute food. Even that would have been doled out with extreme care. And things became so bad within the city that they were selling a dog's head, a rat, A mouse, a quart of horse's blood, some chickweed and starch as well. Not exactly what you men will be looking forward to after your march back today. But Kirk's inactivity stirred up the iron of the Duke of Schomberg. And he received, therefore, orders from Schomberg, commander-in-chief of the English forces in Ireland, get down that foil and relieve the city of Londonderry at once. And so accordingly, on the 28th of July of 1689, we have a number of ships going in there. Mountjoy, which had a connection with the city through its master, who was Micaiah Browning from the city. We had the Phoenix going in, the Dartmouth, a frigate going in with its guns, and they reached the boom that the French engineers had pulled across the foil to prevent any ships coming up and therefore any relief of that city. And that lead ship, the Mountjoy, hit it and fiddled again and got through that boom, broke through. You can imagine, if you're in the city of Meassied, through the famine conditions that are there, you would be absolutely rejoicing at the top of your lungs, if you can get them to function at that stage, at this fluttering of those pennants and flags on the Mountjoy, the Phoenix, and the Dartmouth that day. It meant the siege had failed. A failure for James. Dashed his hopes of conquering the northern part of Ireland, and it gave William of Orange a very firm base in Ulster that then enabled him to ride to victory at the Battle of the Boyne. How did those men do it? Well, you would have found among them there were preachers, Presbyterian men, Church of Ireland men as well, and they were continually preaching the Word of God and keeping the spirits of the people up. What was read by the governor today is one of the verses they would have relied upon. Psalm 37, the verse 3, "Trust in the Lord and do good. So shalt thou dwell in the land, and verily thou shalt be fed." I came across a poem by Cecil Francis Alexander. And it's a long one. I'll not give all of it today by any means, but I would encourage you to check it out. It begins with these words, and she certainly was giving thanks to God for the deliverance. "'Twas the Lord who gave the word when his people drew the sword for the freedom of the present, for the future that awaits. O child, I must remember that bleak day in December when the prentice boys of Derry rose up and shut the gates. There was trouble in the air when we met this day for prayer, and the joyous July morning was heavy in our eyes. Our arms were by the altar as we sang aloud the Psalter and listened in the pauses for the enemy's surprise. Praise the Lord God in the height for the glory of his might. It rang along the arches and it went out to the town. In his strength he hath arisen. He hath loosed the souls in prison. The wronged one he hath righted and raised the fallen down." And in the final verse, "Sing ye praises through the land. The Lord with his right hand, with his mighty arm, hath gotten himself the victory now. He hath scattered their forces, both the riders and their horses. There is none that fighteth for us, O God, but only thou." And through that process, there was a victorious outcome to that excruciating and emaciating siege of the city of Londonderry. That's the initial siege at our main point today. Then we come to think of not only the initial siege, but what I'm calling the incessant siege. You've heard the criticism, it often runs about and is levelled at unionists in Northern Ireland. "You know, you fellas are held by a siege mentality. That's your problem. That's why you never go forward, only back, or try to hold the ground you have. It's this kind of a siege mentality. You know, you're so convinced that your place in the United Kingdom is under threat that you become paranoid and defensive." In the Fountain Estate in Londonderry, I've seen it many, many times, this quote can still be seen. And it's prominently painted on a wall there, "Londonderry, West Bank, Loyalists still under siege, no surrender." Siege mentality. But have we any warrant for this so-called siege mentality? Are our fears justified? Are we still under siege in Northern Ireland? Well, since the creation of Northern Ireland 100 years ago, we have most definitely been under siege. And we've been under siege militarily. Our country had only begun when, back in May of 1922, the IRA launched a northern offensive. A low-intensity war that was waged along the new Irish border between the Free State and Northern Ireland, and they attacked barracks, they burned commercial buildings, they engaged in some large-scale incursions onto the territory of Northern Ireland. They took over Beleek, they took over Petticombe in May and June of that year, and then were repulsed after heavy fighting. But that was May of 1922, already under attack, and the country is only born. Then in 1939, the IRA tried a bombing campaign in England, and again, the objective was the same, to try and force the British to withdraw from Northern Ireland. From 1942 to 44, it mounted another campaign in Northern Ireland. And if that wasn't enough, then comes in the border campaign, 12th of December 1956, through to the 26th of February of 1962. A guerrilla warfare campaign carried out again by the IRA against targets in Northern Ireland with the usual aim of overthrowing British rule and forcing a united Ireland upon the country. And, of course, the Troubles, from the late 1960s through to 1998, claiming the lives along the way of more than 3,500 people, and Republican paramilitaries responsible for some 60% of all of those deaths. Now, we're extremely grateful, looking back across all of these years, that while our country continued to be under siege, we had men like the Ulster Special Constabulary, the B-Specials. During its existence in our country, 95 of those specials were killed in the line of duty. I'm not going to quote a source that would be favourable to us, would be articulating our case, but rather one that would be diametrically opposed to us. Historian Tim Pat Coogan, whose material was required reading for IRA prisoners, but he said of the USC, the B-Specials were the rock on which any mass movement by the IRA in the north has inevitably floundered. We think of the Ulster Defence Regiment as well. Between April of 1970 and June of 1992, 197 of their soldiers were killed on active service. Another 61 were killed, and they were easy targets, of course, because they left Tatum, they lived Tatum, and 61, after they had left the UDR, were slaughtered in cold blood. We're also grateful for the men of the Royal Ulster Constabulary, and the women too in those two forces. That was the police force in Northern Ireland from 1922 through 2001. During the Troubles, 319 RUC officers were killed. Almost 9,000 were injured in paramilitary assassinations or attacks. So we have been under siege, militarily, right from the inception of Northern Ireland. Not only that, there's an ongoing siege that is happening politically. You know as well as I do how the political map of Northern Ireland is rapidly changing. But the mantra from Republicans is no different today than it was yesterday. And it's best illustrated by the comments of a certain Gerry Adams, who at a party meeting in Enniskillen, Monday the 24th of November 2014, and that was shared by the Impartial Reporter, a newspaper down there, they were asking him. And he was saying, you know, they asked me when I go up to Belfast, what is the point in Sinn Féin sharing power with the DUP in Stormont? What's the point in that? But what's the point, he said? The point is to actually break them. And I'll not use the exact words, you will know what he said. That's the point. And what's going to break them is equality. That's what's going to break them. Equality. That's what we need to keep the focus on, and that's the Trojan horse of the entire Republican strategy. And all over these years, IRA Sinn Féin has slithered along a consistent flatbed of dishonesty and deceit, murdering our citizens in cold blood, opposing all expressions of a Protestant culture, including parading routes and flags and bonfires, using the Armalite and the ballot box to lay siege to us politically. It's their game, and they're following it to the T. Also under siege, economically. I'm sure you know that for decades now, Irish nationalists have been claiming that an all-island economy was already developing, and that that would make an all-Ireland state inevitable. I mean, if we're joining the finances, filling in all the dots, connecting it all up economically, then there will be a united Ireland, and that will be the vehicle to deliver it. Now, when it was first mentioned decades ago, it was looked upon as pie in the sky. But now, thanks to the protocol, Northern Ireland's incoming trade from the rest of the UK, as you know, involves extra costs, more bureaucracy, while all of the goods can move across the border into the Republic seamlessly, meaning they are well on the way to achieving what once was an unachievable goal. Worse still, the province's pivotal economic rules will be set by the EU, and with no representation there, Ulster businesses, their conduit to Brussels, will be through Dublin. Even the most optimistic fraudster would have been pushed to consider a coup of this kind of nature. An article appeared in the Militant Left that I don't ordinarily read. I think this is the first time I've read anything from them. Don't even quite know who they are, apart from full-on socialists, but it appeared on the 27th of January 2021 under this title: Northern Ireland, Irish Sea Borders Leaves Unionism Under Siege on the Centenary of the Northern State. As I said, I can't endorse the penman of the article, nor the platform on which he mounted his piece, but neither can I dispute the assertion that's being made here that this protocol severely damages our access to the UK home market and all of our economic dependency over the years of much of Northern Ireland's retail and wholesale sectors. They depended on those British supply chains. They asked a question as well in the middle of the article: a road to British disengagement? Question mark. Despite the promises of Johnson and the Eurosceptic wing of the Tories to political unionism, British capitalism was only too willing to sacrifice the North in negotiations. And that is clearly what has happened. Plus, we have the launch of a government body by the Irish Prime Minister, Michael Martin, in winter 2020. That body was charged with working towards a consensus on a shared island in Ireland. Initially, they proposed the group would be called the United Ireland Unit. But then they thought, no, we'll step back from that, and they have temporarily toned it down, and they're calling it the Shared Island Unit. But the plan is, and they've said this, we will beef it up to prepare for the possibility that England gets turned off Northern Ireland. So the imposition of this protocol, with the huge constitutional and economy ramifications here, is one of the most significant strategic defeats for unionism in the last century. And it's almost incredible it's accomplished on this centenary of our country. Militarily, politically, economically, our country remains under siege. And this is not the product of a wild imagination, but is real. In Psalm 37 and verse 35, the psalmist writes, "I have seen the wicked in great power and spreading himself like a green bay tree." And that's what we're seeing all around us today. But I find comfort in the next verse: "Yet he passed away, and lo, he was not. Yea, I sought him, but he could not be found." It all reminds me of a siege with which the Christian is engaged in this world today, battling the world, battling the flesh, battling the devil. But I read in 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 58 a word of exhortation: "Therefore, my beloved brethren, Be ye steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, for as much as ye know your labour is not in vain in the Lord. And I say today, may the Lord be gracious to us and send us a revival of true biblical religion, for this is the only means of deliverance from a cruel siege that has been laid against us. And what we need are spiritual resurrections, people being born again all around us. Now, our forefathers knew that. That's why they promoted the Reformed faith with as much fervor and faithfulness as they possibly could. That's why they took on the slogan, "Home rule is Rome rule." And we have no desire to be broken, as they put it, under the jackboot of an oppressive Irish state that over the years of our own country's existence has seen approximately 60% of its Protestant citizens either persecuted out or absorbed in. Because the Protestant population in Southern Ireland over the last 100 years has fallen by 175,000 people. The initial siege, the incessant siege, and finally and briefly what I'm calling the invidious siege. Because, call it that, it's the worst siege of all. The invidious siege. More widespread and sustained than the other two I mentioned. It affects not only millions but billions of people. I read in the Bible book of 2 Timothy, the chapter 2 and the verse 26, that every person unconverted, not born again by the Spirit of God, is in the snare of the devil, has been taken captive by him at his will. And I'm told as well, we all need, desperately, we need recovery by Christ. Now, as I go about in the world, and if I'm unsaved, I'll not feel remotely that that's the case. What? Taken captive by the devil, did you say? Caught in his snare? What exactly are you thinking about? That's crazy. And that's exactly what Charles Wesley thought many years ago. Wesley said, "I'm a free man. I'm not in bondage to anybody. I'm in charge of my own affairs. I'm doing the most that anybody could ever expect from me. I'm doing my best." And really, Charles Wesley's best was better than most people's, because though he wasn't converted to Christ, he was a member of an extremely religious organization called the Holy Club in Oxford University. So he's saying, no way am I doing the devil's bidding. I'm reading the Bible. I'm not caught in his trap. But there was a day in Charles Wesley's life when his heart was awakened by the Holy Spirit of God, when he realized what the Bible says about all men is absolutely true. That we are sinners by nature and by practice. That we are hurtling towards a lost eternity. That we are not capable of saving ourselves or working our own way by good works to heaven. That we are in desperate need of Jesus Christ, who alone brings deliverance from sin and shame. And Wesley, having come to Christ as a poor guilty sinner, he sat down and he wrote to him, "Long my imprisoned spirit lay, fast bound in sin and nature's night. Thine eye, God's diffused, a quickening ray. I woke, my dungeon flamed with light. My chains fell off, my heart was free. I rose, went forth, and followed thee." Having thought about the siege of Derry, is there again any more relevant poet that we can quote than Cecil Frances Alexander? In that superb hymn of hers, "There is a green hill far away." And I leave it to those in the Maiden City to dispute with Strabane and all other places as to whether it was written with the Craigan Hill in mind or some other place. But her words are absolutely brilliant. "There was no other good enough to pay the price of sin. He only could unlock the gate of heaven and let us in." Which is why she wrote, "He died that we might be forgiven. He died to make us good, that we might go at last to heaven, saved by his precious blood." That's the way to break the siege. By coming to the cross, lifting up that crimson banner, and traveling under it, giving control to the Savior, and finding deliverance and pardon and joy only in Him.